Supreme Court rules, DACA stands.
What this means for a lot of people who are watching this is that there is still hope.
Legal limbo no more for some 700,000 people who immigrated to the U.S. as kids. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, unconfirmed allegations suggest President Trump voiced support for Uyghur concentration camps in China. We speak with a man whose mother is no longer in those camps, but still lives under constant police surveillance.
There is no freedom at all. She gets visited by the Chinese police or the government officials almost every single day.
And in Indonesia, a surprising way to help protect rainforests, a little extra cash.
They really not want to cut down this forest. They know that it is important for them. They know it's important for their future generations, and they want to protect them.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The Supreme Court has spoken. DACA stands. The court upheld the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program in a 5-4 decision today. The program allows immigrants who come to the U.S. as children, often without authorization, to live here with less fear of deportation. Supporters chanted "Home is here" last fall when the Supreme Court heard the case. It centered on whether President Trump's move to end the Obama-era program in 2017 was illegal. The president voiced his displeasure today in a tweet, saying the ruling was, quote, horrible and politically charged. But many others are celebrating. That includes about 700,000 DACA recipients who are now out of legal limbo, and Juan Escalante, who is with Forward U.S., a bipartisan immigration policy group. He's also a DACA recipient, originally from Venezuela. Escalante joins us from Washington.
Well, I got to tell you, I'm supremely elated and excited. When it comes down to the Supreme Court, I think a lot of us who have had or witnessed cases that have significant impact on the fabric of American life go into it with a certain level of anxiety. For us, that anxiety has culminated today in a positive ruling by the court in which we have discovered that once again, the courts have sided with DACA recipients and with Dreamers and handed a defeat to the Trump administration by telling them that their acts and their actions to try to eliminate the program back in 2017 were in fact illegal.
And just what this means for DACA, is it a clear win? Does the program get reinstated, and will new immigrants be able to apply for the program?
The program has been reverted by the Chief Justice, Justice Roberts, back to its original stance back in 2012, and has told the administration that their acts to try to wind it down were in fact incorrect, and they violated the law in doing so. You know, I have not forgotten that we still live under an administration that has acted against immigrants at every step of the way. So we'll need to examine very clearly what the White House instructs the Department of Homeland Security, USCIS, and what the Trump administration will do next. This decision, while it is a positive one, leaves the program in place. And while it does tell the president that he acted legally, it still leaves the opportunity for the president to terminate the program on his own accord, where he do it in a different manner than the way that they did it back in 2017. So I think the message is clear. You know, the court has ruled. The Trump administration took this to court for 2.5 long years. And at the end of the road, they lost against all odds.
Right. I mean, it is a win, but at 5-4, a narrow win and an outcome that wasn't at all predictable. The court has favored several of the Trump administration's harder line immigration policies in previous decisions. What were you expecting, Juan?
I'm a little bit older in the DACA spectrum of things. I'm 31 years old. A lot of the people who are beneficiary of the programs are much younger. But I've been essentially an immigration advocate for almost half of my life. I started doing this work since 16. And in order to do this work, you have to have essentially a sense of hope, because without it, you can't advance. And that, I say that not just because we live under an administration that uses its position of power to wield attacks against immigrants. I say namely because I have seen the so-called DREAM Act pass and fail in Congress. Mm. I have seen, you know, mass deportations of people under Democratic and Republican administrations. And I have seen immigration reform packages come and go. And I think that for you to continue to essentially be behind this work and continue to move forward with it, you need to have a sense of hope. It may sound kind of silly, but that's the way that I presented myself today. I told myself that I wasn't going to be scared, that I wasn't going to let this essentially slow me down in life, and that, you know, whatever happened, you know, would happen. And guess what? The court realized that the best outcome was to make sure that they ruled with the law and with the facts.
Personally for you, Juan, I mean, this is not the end of the road, but it's a big day, it sounds like.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think overwhelmingly, you know, for me, this reaffirms for people right out there that we want to continue to put our best foot forward. Mm. What this means for a lot of people who are watching this is that there is still hope, and that this program, even though it continues to be a fragile exercise in discretionary action that allows us to, you know, be spared from deportation, work and drive without the fear of deportation in 2-year increments, the program is still here. And what the White House needs to understand is that they lost and that they need to back off from any attacks. And simultaneously speaking, it also means that for the allies and for the millions of people who continue to support us, the time is now. We need to seize this opportunity, call on our elected leaders in Congress, and have them pass legislation that codify these protections into law.
At a 5-4 vote, do you think the message from the Supreme Court is strong enough that the Trump White House will stop those attacks?
I can't give you any sort of certainty of that. This has been one of the most unpredictable administrations that has done away with the quorum. A normal president will see this as a decisive defeat and will step away and, you know, realize that. Who knows what his advisors, primarily Stephen Miller, who is basically an immigration hawk, will say and do in the next coming days. And while it is a moment of celebration, and I got to tell you, I'm definitely excited given everything that has happened, we continue to be very vigilant, because if we know anything, it's that this White House does not give up.
What does today's ruling change about how you view the United States, Juan, and how immigrants are seen within the country?
I think ultimately this is another step in the right direction. But at the same time, you know, it's just one step of many. We continue to witness unspeakable horrors at the national level. It wasn't too long ago that we were protesting children in cages. It wasn't too long ago that, you know, the Trump administration shut down asylum processes and that is trying to essentially undo the legal immigration system. While this is welcome news, right, it's not essentially the end of the road. And I have to recognize that, and I have to say that out loud. We have to keep pushing. The work doesn't end.
Juan Escalante is with Forward U.S., a bipartisan immigration policy group. He's been speaking with us from Washington. Thank you very much, Juan, for your time.
Thank you.
The legal battle over DACA goes back years. The twists and turns are a reminder of American politics, but also the deep impact DACA has had on the lives of immigrants. Check out a DACA timeline and the story it tells. Our team has that for you at theworld.org. In Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, just across the Texas border, there's a hotel that reflects the pandemic times we are in. It's filling up with guests, but they're not tourists on vacation. They're migrants who tried to cross the U.S. border, but for a variety of reasons have been sent back. The people who run the place call it a filter hotel, filtering out people who might have the coronavirus to keep the guests from getting sick. KERA's Mallory Falk visited to see how it works.
The Hotel Flamingo is a motel, really. It's faded pink, 2 stories, off of a busy street near downtown Juarez. There's outdoor space, and when you arrive, there's a whole disinfection process, led by Rosa Mani Arias. First, you clean off your shoes with bleach. Then you scrub your hands with soap, followed up with hand sanitizer, and then you're given a face mask. And finally, Mani sprays your shoes with an alcohol mixture. Mani is with a local branch of the World Organization for Peace, an international nonprofit. It's one of several groups supporting the Filter Hotel. Here in Juarez and along the Mexican border, migrant shelters are trying to control the spread of COVID-19, so they can't just immediately take new people in. This filter hotel offers a safe place to quarantine before people can go to a longer-term shelter. After new guests wash up, Mani leads them to a waiting area and explains the setup. There's a health screening, then guests are assigned a private room. Leticia Chavarria is the hotel's medical coordinator. Chavarria says this hotel is taking migrants off the street and away from the risk of potential infection. There's an isolation wing for people with COVID symptoms, and there's another wing for everyone else. Protocols are strict. Once a doctor goes up to the isolation area, she can't come down until her shift's over. Anything she needs gets sent up in a bucket on the end of a rope. It's like a makeshift elevator, Chavarria jokes. There's room for 108 guests here. Right now, it's nearly full. Some of the migrants, because of a Trump administration policy, must wait in Mexico as their asylum cases play out in the U.S. Others, like this woman from Honduras, were rejected at the U.S. border based on a public health order about COVID-19. She asked not to use her name out of fear for her family's safety. Standing outside her room, she takes in the fresh air. Her 4-year-old son plays with blocks next to her. She says she sold candy in Honduras, earning just enough to get by. Then a gang tried to extort her, but she couldn't pay. She says the gang told her she had less than 12 hours to leave the country, or else. She fled with her 2 children. They managed to cross the U.S.-Mexico border, but she says they were detained by U.S. officials. She says the officials grabbed her worse than you would an animal, and that her shirt was ripped. She says her family was then dropped off at a bridge that connects El Paso and Juarez. They didn't tell me anything, she says. It was really ugly. Mexican officials brought her to the Filter Hotel. She says she's grateful to be here, but isn't sure what's next. She can't go back to her country. For now, though, she has a safe place to stay. It's homey here. There's colorful flower pots on the windowsill and paintings by kids around. Everyone gets checkups from volunteer doctors. Eunice Gonzalez is one of those doctors, all women, who work here. Gonzalez identifies with the guests. She's an asylum seeker. She left Cuba last year and has been living in Juarez, too, waiting for her own court date in the U.S. Gonzalez says she misses practicing medicine. So when she heard about the Filter Hotel, she signed up to help monitor people while they quarantined. She says it's a huge honor to get up every morning, come here, and put on my white coat. But this so-called Filter Hotel is just one spot with a limited number of rooms. Gonzalez and the other volunteers know. For every migrant who finds their way here, there are many others who do not. For The World, I'm Mallory Falk in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico.
John Bolton's yet-to-be-released tell-all book has Washington stirred up. But for China watchers, the allegations the former national security advisor makes are not just Beltway gossip. We look at what's at stake for the Uyghur community in all of this. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We've been reporting on it for more than 2 years, but it's still hard to come to terms with the fact that China has concentration camps. The estimated 1 million inmates in the west of the country are Uyghurs, a mostly Muslim minority. President Trump signed a law yesterday authorizing sanctions on Chinese officials involved with those camps. But on the same day, allegations surfaced that President Trump told China last year he was fine with the camps. Those details came from a leaked excerpt of a book by former National Security Advisor John Bolton and have not been verified. Bonnie Glazer is director of the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington.
Well, we don't know whether or not President Trump actually did support or imply that he supported the policy in China of imprisoning Uyghurs. But I believe that it makes sense because President Trump has really not paid much attention to human rights or the Uyghurs issue in particular. President Trump has been focused primarily on trade and the bilateral trade deficit that the United States has with China.
The administration, as you know, is defending itself from Bolton's allegation by highlighting the Uyghur human rights law that the president signed yesterday. What does that actually do?
Well, the law itself simply requires President Trump and his administration to submit a report to Congress identifying Chinese officials and other individuals who are responsible for the detention of Uyghurs without charges and trial and degrading, inhumane treatment of these groups. But apart from that report, it is uncertain whether or not the administration would apply sanctions to individuals. So the legislation gives the administration the right to impose sanctions, and this could include asset blocking, visa revocations, even ineligibility for people to enter the United States. But the legislation really gives the White House room to opt against imposing sanctions if they choose so. So there's no automaticity.
So there seems to be a glaring contradiction between the new law and the sentiments alleged in John Bolton's book. How are we supposed to square that circle? Can both be true?
Well, the president, in the period of trade negotiations with China, I think just did not want to take on any other issues that might disrupt those negotiations and prevent an agreement. The United States and China, of course, signed a phase one trade agreement in January. And now the president's priorities appear to have changed. He is now focused on winning re-election. And public opinion polls show that Americans have a high degree of unfavorability toward China, that they see threats emanating from China. So I believe that President Trump is trying to use this issue to win votes and achieve his re-election. So his whole goals have changed.
China publicly denies the mass incarceration of the Uyghur people, but we also know of cases of Uyghurs who have been affiliated with Al-Qaeda and ISIS. So has there ever been a suggestion of China justifying the mass incarceration of Uyghurs on national security grounds?
Yes, the Chinese have explicitly said that there are Uyghurs who have been involved in terrorist actions. And there have been a handful of terrorist actions in China over the last 10 years. But there is not a great deal of evidence that upwards of 2 to 3 million people are connected to some terrorism ring.
Bonnie Glaser, we'll leave it there. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That was Bonnie Glaser, director of the China Power Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Uyghurs in the United States have been following all of this very closely. Furkat Jodad is a software engineer in Virginia. He's worked to get the Uyghur Human Rights Law enacted. So, Furkat, now that it's been signed by President Trump, how are you feeling?
This is really exciting, and then kind of became a relief for all of us, like, who have been doing all we can do while risking our family members who are still living inside of China. So it is really a huge step and a victory, I would say.
It comes at the same time as John Bolton's excerpt from his upcoming book, in which he alleges Trump okayed detainment camps, concentration camps in China for Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities. Does that change at all how you feel about the legislation passing?
I got mixed feelings. At some point that kind of feel as an American, and then especially working for the U.S. government as a software engineer, but kind of felt betrayal because it's really personal to me that my own president okayed that the Chinese government to build those camps, which locked up my mom for more than 15 months. But by saying that he signed a bill and then made it into law, it was kind of relieving. So I just hope this bill will be the first major step in the Uyghur history so we can put more sanctions and then more limitations to the Chinese government or the officials, and then put an end to the camps as well as the forced labor.
This is personal for you, Furkat. Your family is still in Western China. When we spoke last year, you described how your mother has been affected by this. Are you able now to be in touch with her?
Yes, I can talk to her, but the communication has been really limited, especially after last November, my mom's story was published on the New York Times podcast. And later on, there was a documentary about my mom's story in the EJ Plus. Her internet at home was cut off. And then also this year, mid-February, her phone just stopped working. So it was really worrisome for us, as I wasn't able to talk to her for more than 45 days. And then after that, she got another number as permitted by the Chinese police. But now I can only talk to her through phone calls. I cannot even do FaceTime or video calls with my mom.
And how free do you feel to express yourself to her and she to you in those calls?
There is no freedom at all. Everything we have to talk is, we all know that's been listened by the Chinese police.
At some point, you must be wondering whether she is self-censoring or whether there was a kind of brainwashing going on. Do you think about that?
Just a couple of days ago, the Chinese local government officials, they came to her house and asked her to write a statement saying that she was well taken care of by the Chinese government, the local government officials, and then just praising how she was being taken care of.
Has all of this affected your relationship with your mother? I mean, if you feel like you're not hearing the truth because of censorship or other reasons, I mean, that's got to be difficult.
It is, because I used to talk to my mom about almost everything. But now, I have to be really careful. And then, as in our culture and also in like Islam, like we start the conversation by saying assalamu alaikum. But since that's been kind of qualified it as illegal in China right now, I just start by saying hi. And then everything we talk about is like we had to be really careful before we speak out.
The Chinese government has actually labeled you a terrorist. Will you be speaking out about all of this? And do you worry that continued activism could end up by targeting your family back in China?
So since they called me as a terrorist, I haven't got any direct threat to myself or my family here in the U.S., but the indirect threat is through my mom. So all those limitations is mainly towards me and then pushing me to stop speaking out. But I got no other choice.
Farkat Jawdat is a software engineer in Virginia. He's active in the Uyghur human rights community. Farkat, it's good to speak with you again. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. A Filipina journalist goes to the mat fighting for press freedom.
I felt like I'd spent my entire career going to the gym to get ready for this moment.
I'm Marco Werman. Journalist Maria Ressa faces 6 years in prison for cyber libel. She compares reporting in the Philippines right now to working in a war zone. Her story coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. Preserving forests is key to fighting climate change, but it is an uphill battle. We lose some 19 million acres of forests each year. Today, we're looking at an accidental solution to part of the problem on this week's installment of The Big Fix.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
This story is set in Indonesia. It has some of the largest, most biodiverse forests in the world and also some of the highest rates of deforestation. The World's Anna Kusmer shares with us new research with a surprising finding that helping forests might start with helping people first.
In a promotional video by the Indonesian government, a man is standing by his wooden home. He's sawing a board and telling his friend that his roof is leaking on both sides. He doesn't have the funds to fix it. A woman walks by and says, hey, there's this program that can help give you money to fix your house. That program is part of a larger anti-poverty effort in Indonesia that serves over 10 million households. Vivi Ulaswati helped create the program at the Ministry of Planning. A big part of it is direct cash transfers to people struggling to get by to help them in the short term.
In the longer term, the program want to break the poverty, the vicious cycle, particularly for the next generation.
A new study out this week shows that these cash transfers have another totally unexpected outcome, saving rainforests in a country where more trees are cut down each day than almost anywhere else in the world.
When the poorest households receive cash transfers from the government, the rainforests around those villages experience 30% less deforestation on average
Paul Ferraro from Johns Hopkins University is one of the study authors and says about half of the saved forests were old growth with big old trees that store a lot of carbon.
These are the beautiful rainforests everybody thinks of when they think of rainforests that are ecologically and economically the most valuable. So the cash transfers reduce deforestation in the rainforest that environmentalists are trying to protect.
Forest fires and clearing for large-scale agriculture and mining are the biggest drivers of deforestation in Indonesia, which has the third most forest cover in the world. But small-scale illegal clearing and logging is still a significant part of the problem. For many Indonesians facing poverty, cutting down trees is a form of insurance. They clear land to expand their farms in years when the harvest is bad. They also chop down trees and sell timber for extra cash. With the cash payments, people are more secure and don't need to cut the trees, says Rita Simorangkir at the National University of Singapore. She's the study's other author.
When the government transfers cash to them, they make their budget more flexible. So I think this is like giving them options.
Fighting poverty and protecting the environment are often seen as conflicting priorities, and there's some evidence to support that. A 2013 study in Mexico found that cash transfer to poor people increased deforestation. That was likely because when given more cash, people could afford more beef, and they cleared more land for cattle. But in Indonesia, Simorangkir and Paul Ferraro found that the opposite ended up being true.
We hope that our study gives people some hope that these twin goals that we have globally don't necessarily need to be at odds.
Well, my initial thought is I'm super happy to read the paper.
That's Monica Nirmala. She works at a health clinic in Indonesian Borneo that incentivizes forest protection by providing discounted health care. She says the study's findings confirm her team's experience over 14 years there.
And what we have found, like clearly over and over again, is that these people really want the forest for the future, and they really do not want to cut down this forest. They know that it is important for them. They know it's important for their, children and future generations, and they want to protect them. But often they do not have the choice to do so.
In this case, in Indonesia, when people have options, it's both good for them and the forest. For the World, I'm Anna Kusmer.
Turkey is on the offensive again after helping the Libyan government quash a year-long assault on its capital, Tripoli. Turkey is also now focusing its attention on northern Iraq. Over the past few days, Turkey has stepped up strikes against Kurdish militants there. The Turkish government says it's simply responding to a recent increase in attacks by Kurdish PKK forces on its border posts. But the move is raising tensions in the region. Duri Buskaran is a reporter based in Istanbul. Duri, what exactly are we seeing here? Is Turkey flexing its muscles again in northern Iraq and just testing regional powers?
Turkey really sees this as a domestic issue. This assault is a much bigger, bolder version of what they've been doing regularly in recent years to attack the PKK and militias that it says are affiliated with the PKK. The U.S. has supported Kurdish militias affiliated with the PKK in both Iraq and Syria. I mean, first, this was to rout ISIS and like the rescue of Yazidi women on Mount Sinjar. This is the same area. And they're still there supporting to maintain the status quo. And the U.S. says that these militias were the best option they had in an incredibly complex situation. But to Turkey, that meant that a NATO ally was arming Turkey's enemy on Turkey's doorstep. And Ankara has not been comfortable with that situation.
So the Kurdistan Workers Party, the PKK, one of the players here, they've been in open conflict with Turkey for 3.5 decades now. The PKK has been designated a terrorist group by the U.S. and the EU. Do you think this latest escalation is a result solely of PKK attacks on these border posts, as Turkey says?
I think that Erdogan sees an opening here. He tested the waters first by invading largely Kurdish areas of Syria, that border zone, with the same goal in mind, to rout the PKK, push back groups Ankara sees as sympathetic to them. Pro-government analysts say that this is successful, that PKK attacks only stopped in Turkey when Erdogan took the fight outside of his borders. As one analyst I talked to, Nicholas Danforth, pointed out, Turkey is pushing for military action while simultaneously jailing and harassing Kurdish political figures back home. If they really wanted to stop the PKK, Turkey would be looking for a political solution too, and that they don't seem to be doing. So this leads you to wonder if part of it is a chance to score political points among nationalists at a particularly testy time.
Right. If that is the theory, why now? Why stepping up this military action now?
I mean, I think there's competing theories. And I think that what you'll hear from Turkey is that they have the PKK kind of back on their feet. And I think Turkey is feeling emboldened. They've put a lot of money in military infrastructure. And the PKK is considered a very serious threat. They don't see NATO and the U.S. taking it seriously.
This is all coming as Turkey is getting increasingly involved in Libya and in Syria. You mentioned Syria. What is Erdogan's angle here? What is he trying to achieve? Is it all about domestic politics in Turkey?
I mean, I think you have to separate some of these. Turkey's goals in Iraq and Syria are very similar. It's related to the PKK, but Libya is a completely different story. They've been supporting the UN recognized government and violating a UN arms embargo, not only to arm the Tripoli government, but also to send in mercenary fighters from Syria. On a philosophical level, Turkey has a bloody history of coups and coup attempts. So Erdogan doesn't want to support anyone challenging a democratically elected government in another country.
So Erdogan is getting bolder in his military actions. Given that Erdogan and Donald Trump talk on the phone and seem to basically get along, what is the role of the U.S. in all of this?
I think that Erdogan is ambitious. He wants Turkey to be taken seriously on a military level, and he's invested a lot in drones, fighter jets, even an S-400 air defense system from Russia over NATO objections that now may not even go into service. But everywhere that Turkey is getting involved, be it Syria, Libya, or Somalia, I mean, they have stated domestic interests in mind. They're also choosing places that the U.S. and Europe have a smaller footprint. I mean, they don't want to challenge the U.S. directly, but they want a seat at the table.
Reporter Duri Baskaran is based in Istanbul. Thank you for being with us, Duri.
Thank you, Marco.
You know the home shopping network? Well, in China, shoppers are hooked on an updated version, live-streamed videos hawking everything from lipstick to air purifiers. From Shanghai, the world's Rebecca Canther tells us about some of the more unlikely live-streaming stars, farmers.
Just like in the U.S., in China, TikTok is full of funny videos, odd challenges, and also some surprisingly convincing sales pitches. In this one, a farmer who goes by the name Northern Big Sis sits in her greenhouse, taking giant bites of the raw vegetables she grows on her farm. I can't lie, she's got me hooked. It's nothing exciting. All she does is chomp her way through onions, garlic, and other vegetables. But I can't stop swiping to see what she'll eat next. Pretty soon, my eye is drawn to a button above the video that will let me buy her produce. And before you know it, I've ordered 3 packs of the pickled bamboo shoots that I just watched her eat. I can pay for them all without leaving the TikTok app. The next day, a package arrives on my doorstep. It's my bamboo shoots, packed with ice. Live streaming is big business in China. And with everyone stuck at home earlier this year because of the COVID pandemic, companies large and small had a captive audience.
And it was already rising quite quickly, but all of a sudden with COVID, it's just gone gangbusters.
That's Mark Tanner. He's the founder of China Skinny, a market research agency based in Shanghai. He says there was a 730% rise in brand live streaming in February alone. And he's been surprised at how much of a hit farmers have been. Millions of viewers tune in to watch them sell their produce.
So you're getting a large number of these farmers that have all of a sudden become mini celebrities.
He says part of the appeal is that many Chinese people in the city are curious about life in the countryside. But the promise of a bargain is also a draw.
Chinese consumers, like any consumers, they love a deal. So they're getting this deal and they're getting entertained at the same time.
Some farmers are getting really creative in how they hawk their wares. Take this group of young farmers who post videos of their farming fashion show on TikTok and Kuaishou, another live streaming app. 4 young guys strut down a red carpet in the middle of a field in rural Guangxi province, clothed in nothing but the food they sell. Garlic strands, bamboo leaves, handmade noodles, strings of chives and hot peppers. They make for some amazingly hilarious and mouthwatering outfits. these videos already have a major fan base. Some 400,000 viewers tune in every day to watch. And right there embedded in the video is a link to the products they're selling. This new sales approach has helped a lot of farmers hit hard by the COVID lockdown. That includes Yang Qingfeng, who runs a 16-acre family farm on the outskirts of Shanghai. His first attempt at live streaming included a cooking demonstration on a makeshift stove in the middle of a field. Yang says he wants to teach shoppers about where their food comes from. Live streaming is a little bit like selling at the farmer's market, Yang says. Shoppers can communicate with us and see how we harvest. They can ask questions and we can answer. That way the customers can see for themselves and they're more likely to buy. Yang's broadcast worked on Rong Wei, a shopper who lives in the center of Shanghai. She was fascinated to learn how wild rice actually grows, and she wound up buying some, along with eggs and chicken to give to her friends. She says, watching him explain his farming process made us want to eat the crops. The wild rice looked delicious. There was a bit of educational value, too. So will growers around the world take up live streaming like Chinese farmers have? Mark Tanner, the market analyst, says their success can't be easily replicated.
Chinese people are much more engaged with digital, and particularly e-commerce, and they adopt new technologies faster than anyone. And they also have incredibly well-integrated payment systems.
He says it's unlikely this trend will catch on in the West with quite the same speed. In China, farmers are already becoming influencers. For the world, I'm Rebecca Kanther in Shanghai.
You can get a sneak peek of the stories we're looking at each day, hours before they hit the airwaves, a quick hit of stories we're chasing from around the globe, right in your email inbox. Sign up to receive our morning newsletter, Top of the World, on our website, theworld.org/newsletters. Again, that's theworld.org/newsletters. Filipina journalist Maria Ressa has spent years staring down one of the world's most ruthless dictators, Rodrigo Duterte. She has not blinked yet. But this week, a Manila court convicted Ressa and a former colleague at the news site she founded of the crime of cyber libel. She could face up to 6 years in prison. Ressa is now out on bail while she appeals the verdict. Her alleged crime involved a 2012 article written on her site, Rappler, that linked a Filipino businessman to human trafficking and drug smuggling. Ressa told me that the legal acrobatics the Filipino government had to perform to get to a guilty verdict, they're a saga of their own.
In 2014, someone in Rappler noticed a typographical error in this 2012 article, and they changed one letter of one word. Based on that, I could go to jail for 6 years because the judge then ruled that that is republication. And of course, we're going to challenge this, and I hope I do get justice at some point.
It sounds like a really Kafka-esque situation you find yourself in. Are you preparing yourself mentally for the possibility of going to jail?
It took me a month of really thinking about it. I talked to other journalist friends who had been imprisoned, and I realized that the path I was on, that I would need to start thinking about this. I had to confront that.
President Duterte has called journalists, as you know, quote, sons of bitches. He says journalists are not exempt from assassination. I'm wondering, though, do you think on some level you intimidate Duterte? Are the attacks on you personal on some level for him?
I'm not sure. The last time I spoke with him directly was in December of 2016. That was his first year in office. I was one of four journalists that he gave interviews to, right? And I think that the Duterte administration makes examples of people. So among businessmen, he focused early on, after he took office, on a businessman whose company he named, and that company's stocks dropped and they were forced to sell. On politicians, it's Senator Laila de Lima, who was head of the Commission on Human Rights and was running after him for human rights violations when he was still mayor. She has been imprisoned in February 2017, and she is still in prison until today. And then for journalists, I'm a cautionary tale. And I think that there's some level of threat that if we can do this to her, imagine what we can do to you.
Does his language frighten you?
It's something that we gradually accepted in Rappler. And then when we were confronted bit by bit with decisions that we had to make, the choice was always very clear. And part of that probably was because the women who founded Rappler were older. I was in my 50s already at that point. I felt like I'd spent my entire career going to the gym to get ready for this moment, right? So frightened. By the time I realized the path I was on, I just, you know, spent some time to wrap my head around it. In the same way that for the Monday verdict, I sat and accepted the worst case scenario. Mm. And if I was okay with the worst case scenario, then everything else will be all right.
I know a lot of Filipinos support President Duterte. What is it like for you battling such a popular dictator when he's got that support behind him?
He was one of five presidential candidates, and he didn't win substantially. In fact, he won only a small majority over the five, right? I think he definitely is a popular president. His authoritarian style of leadership was what Filipinos wanted during great times of uncertainty. The fact that he says what he thinks, he seems like every man. But he's also aided by a propaganda machine on social media. And these disinformation networks seed these narratives that really take on a life of their own and float his reputation. You know, that one of the most familiar narratives is that he's just like me. He is the best president this country will ever have. I have never, and I've gone around a lot in the Philippines, no one has ever come to my face to say or do the things that they do on social media. I've been a journalist for a long time. This next year will be my 35th year. And this is part of the reason I worry about the manipulation of the public sphere through social media.
You've been working as a journalist since 1986. What will stop you from reporting?
I hope nothing. I mean, I did conflict reporting in Southeast Asia for CNN. I've worked in war zones. And this time period with the kind of hate and the exponential attacks you get on social media, the weaponization of the law. This is tougher. This is a tougher environment to work in than a war zone because you don't know where the attacks are going to come from, right? There's a Damocles sword hanging over your head all the time. When I look at my colleagues in the Philippines, look, the largest newspaper was attacked first by the president. The largest television station was just shut down about a month ago. We were the third attacked. And what I've learned is that we need to swat away the Damocles sword, because if you allow it to change the way you do your journalism, then they win. I always wonder, why is our government attacking us so much? Why do they not want the questions in the time of COVID? It almost seems like right now they're codifying into law the abuses of our rights that have happened on an ad hoc basis. So this is a precipice that we need to make sure we don't fall off the edge and lose our democracy.
Do you have an answer to why? Why is the government going after journalists?
It's a consolidation of power. The perfect storm of social media, President Duterte's style of leadership. In my last interview with him, I had asked him, you know, do you need to use violence? And he just categorically said yes. He feels that violence and fear are important aspects of leadership. I don't know where this will lead, but we certainly, because of technology, because of the weaponization of the law, we're in a new area. The 8 criminal charges I have, cumulatively, I could face 100 years in jail, almost 100 years in jail. But I look away from that and look at where we are today and see that we have to actively push. It is a battle for truth, right? And in a battle for truth, journalists are advocates.
Maria Ressa is the founder of the online news outlet Rappler Media. She faces 6 years in prison after being convicted of cyber libel, a charge she says is fabricated by the government of the Philippines. Maria, thank you very much for your time. Good to speak with you.
Thanks for having me.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. When we're not here on the air, find us on Twitter. We're at The World. You can find me there, too. I'm at Marco Werman. Stay safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.